Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
On some level, I sort of feel obligated to say, here's hoping your team won, you know, in the midst of football season, college football, NFL, and all the rest, high school football. That's all I could say. It's all I could do, really. I hope your team won. And beyond that, I would only want to say good morning and welcome. It's 6:04, and this is Faith Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a supporter of ours. Get on board at myfaithradio.com. You can find us there anytime on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for listening. I'm honored to be with you weekday morning, 6 till 8. How do you navigate the terrain of social media and actually raise children who are sociable all at the same time? Kind of a challenge, actually. And coming up just about a half an hour from now, you're going to meet a lady named Arlene Pelicane. She was with us recently, actually, last week, but she'll join us again to talk about her brand new book. She's co-authored a book, and it's quite fascinating. I mean, I think she spells it out, makes the case to say that the era of social media has literally given rise. It's not just your imagination, it's not mine. It has given rise to more antisocial or unsocial behavior. One of the points that she makes is to say that, you know, when you just fire off a nasty instant message or email or text or what have you, or somebody does that to you, there's no human one-on-one in-person sort of reaction such that we cannot see the hurtfulness that our comment causes. We cannot see, nor can the other person, if they're insulting us, they cannot see how their comments hurt us. There's no visual response. You don't hear necessarily a tone in the voice or the verbal cues, those kinds of things. And that's just scratching the surface. Anyway, Arlene Pelicane, co-author of the book Growing Up Social, along with, and how's this for a co-author, Dr. Gary Chapman. Thank you, Arlene. Nice team there. Anyway, Arlene Pelicane joins us coming up at about 6:35 this morning, so stand by for that. We are in the midst of a month of efforts to prevent suicide across the United States. And don't you suppose that the church, universally speaking, the church, the Christian church in our country, should have something to say about that? Into the 7 o'clock hour, we will speak with Karen Mason, Dr. Karen Mason, an associate professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in Massachusetts. And she'll talk to us about efforts that churches are making and efforts that churches can make to reach out to those who are hurting and suffering as we seek to prevent suicide in our country. So that's coming up later into the 7 o'clock hour as well. Now, I'm really looking forward to speaking to our next guest who is along here in just a few moments. He's a gentleman who's authored a book called Shrink. Shrink. And that's the title. The subtitle is Faithful Ministry in a Church Growth Culture. Yes, indeed, church success for way too many years here in the United States of America and elsewhere has been defined in terms of the number of people attending every weekend, numbers of bodies in the pews. It's been defined the way the culture defines success oftentimes in terms of numbers and number of people consuming, and even in some cases defined by the number of dollars flowing into the coffers. How does one continue and conduct faithful ministry, as author Tim Suttle calls it, in a church growth culture? We'll talk about Shrink when we come back. I can't say that normally. It's a fun title, but a very poignant and very important one as well. All of this just ahead. It's now 6:08, and you're listening to Faith Radio. We're glad you're with us. Welcome to Monday. I'm Austin Hill. Good morning and welcome. It's Faith Radio and I'm Austin Hill. So we live in a church growth culture, wouldn't you say? For most of my adult life, churches, evangelical churches, have been immersed in notions of church growth and getting bigger. I've grown up and lived most all of my life in the era of the so-called evangelical megachurch. Joining us to talk about this, though, is a man who's got a very different outlook on things. He's author of a brand new book called Shrink. He is the senior pastor of Redemption Church in Kansas City. He has planted three successful churches over the past 12 years, but he has focus on other things besides size and numbers. Tim Suttle joins us on the guest line. Tim Suttle, welcome to Faith Radio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Austin.
Can we call your book Shrink? Can we call this counterintuitive? Would that be a good starting point?
I think so, or at least counter our instincts in the way that we have been raised and the narrative in which we've been raised. I haven't heard, it's just coming out today. Today is its release date, but mm-hmm. I haven't heard a ton of critique yet. But I know as it comes out, it's pushing against some of our sacred cows.
Yeah, sacred cows, I presume, that have become sacred in sort of a cultural sense, but as I understand your book, Tim, those things are not necessarily made sacred by scriptural truth. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's really the heart of the critique. What I'm trying to say is that I think there is a difference between there's leadership and there's Christian leadership, and the word Christian modifies leadership so as to make it categorically different from any other mode of leadership. And you're right, I think it's a cultural thing. Our society is fascinated with success. And the American story is about bigger, better, higher, stronger, and faster. And it's very pragmatic, so we'll do whatever makes us effective to help all of our, graphs go up and to the right. And that's the American story. But that's not the Christian story. And the Christian story has a different twist. It says the first will be last, right? The greatest will be the servant.
Sure. Tim Suttle is a pastor from Kansas City. He is the author of a brand new book called Shrink, Faithful Ministry in a Church Growth Culture. Give us an idea of how, American pragmatism has shaped and formed evangelical Christianity, maybe in terms of church growth beliefs and attitudes and philosophies, but those assumptions aren't necessarily biblical. Cite an example, if you would, please.
Yeah, there's actually a pastor who had been an evangelist and was starting his own church in a major metropolitan city, and have a lot of friends in this city. And when he was launching his church, one of the tactics he used is he called around and had his folks on his core team call around, and they collected the directory, church directories from all the small churches in most of the city. And when they did their direct mailings, they mailed directly to the membership roles of other churches, hoping that as they did this, they would tap into some folks who weren't happy or where they were. And this actually gave them an extremely successful launch. Mm-hmm. They launched in the thousands, but I think that we would not want to call that a particularly faithful way to plant a church.
Well, I would say from the vantage point of small business, we call that guerrilla marketing in the world of small business.
That
strikes me as kind of odd, to say the least, for trying to grow one's church. But you're saying this actually happened.
Yeah, it's a real thing. Yeah, and it began what was then in the saga of the life of this pastor and his church. It began what I would call a really sad success story, where they grew huge, had huge problems, all connected to this kind of integrity compromise, and then have since folded up, and the church is no more. And that really is the thing. It's the contrast I keep pulling to the forefront is the difference between chasing success and chasing faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And those things intersect, but not always. And I think the problem is that most pastors of churches, with the pressure to grow and be successful and get everything to move up and to the right, they begin to rationalize just about anything that they can do to grow. And because I think we're even lacking in some theological insight as to what it means to be the church, you know, a real robust doctrine of church, I think it makes it even more likely that we'll make subtle compromises that we don't even realize run completely, you know, 180 degrees against the way of Christ.
Very interesting. Tim Settle, he's a pastor from Kansas City. He's also the author of a brand new book, comes out today. It's called Shrink, Faithful Ministry in a Church Growth Culture. Is a church, there's some, I guess, line of demarcation, Tim, some number in mind that maybe you have in mind of church attendance, where you look and if a particular church is surpassing that number or they're at that number, that particular size, they're kind of suspects. I mean, is there something you have in mind here? And I'm wondering, I mean, would somebody look at your church that you pastor in Kansas City and say, well, but, you know, this isn't a shrinking church here. This is growing and growing and growing. I mean, how do you size this up? Pun intended, yeah. But I'm trying to get something at something important.
No, it's a great question. I don't think we can put a number on it. I really don't. I think it's more of a mentality. I know that when I was planting the first church that I helped plant, we were planting in the mega church mentality, and it was a struggle. But we were acting. We had mega church leadership attitudes and practices from the get go. Even though we were at 40, 50 people, and these kind of things, these practices, one of the things that they do really, really well is for people who are caught up in systems that are about success and effectiveness when it comes to ministry, it produces kind of a consistent anxiety in the people. We're not enough, right? Who we are right now isn't right because we have to grow in order to be okay. And that anxiety becomes systemic. And so that's what I look for, is more of the anxiety. It really, and this has, there's some rich biblical imagery too that supports this. Like, for instance, in the Old Testament, the Tower of Babel story, when the people come together to build this huge tower and they say, come, let us make a name for ourselves. And so I sometimes wonder, I mean, you contrast that with John the Baptist, and when all his followers are leaving him, he's shrinking, and they're going to follow after Jesus, and his guys come and say, John, what's the deal? You know, we're losing market share here. Mm-hmm. And John says, I must decrease, he must increase. And so what I'm always looking for in the attitudes of leadership and of congregations is, if we're chasing ministry greatness, I think we're telling the story of our culture. And so the thing we have to ask ourselves is, are we trying to make a name for ourselves? Or are we getting out of the way and shrinking down our egos and learning how to get smaller and to be faithful and leave the results up to God?
Very interesting. Shrink, Faithful Ministry in a Church Growth Culture. That's the title of a brand new book. Pastor Tim Settle is its author. He's on our guest line. It's 6:18. We'll continue with Pastor Tim Settle right after this. Don't go away. It's Faith Radio. Good morning. I'm Austin Hill. It's 6:20 at Faith Radio. Shrink, Faithful Ministry in a Church Growth Culture. That's the title of a brand new book that is released today. Its author is Pastor Tim Settle. He's a pastor from Kansas City, and he's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. Tim, I wanted to ask, I guess, at least one follow-up question here, and that is the common belief that if the numbers are big, if a lot of people are flocking to a particular church or a particular event or venue, well, it must be a good thing, and you know, God's doing something, and what we're seeing happen is of the Lord, so to speak. I say this because I grew up in Southern California, right in the back door of the emergence of the Calvary Chapel church denomination. Calvary Chapel, where its epicenter is at in Costa Mesa, California, Southern California suburb. And I remember adults in my parents' peer group saying, well, those are a bunch of hippies, and you know, they don't dress nicely, and they show up to church, and you know, they just look awful and whatever. And Pastor Chuck Smith was kind of new on the scene at that point. And my mom would always say, but look at the numbers. Look at the thousands of young people that are flocking to hear God's word. There's something going on there. God is at work in that church. Now, I'm not questioning the validity of Calvary Chapel. That's not the point here. I'm not questioning that God was doing things there. But that always seems to be the case. If the numbers are big, well, this is of God. And what you're suggesting is almost kind of counter to that. Tell us your thoughts on that notion.
Yeah, I that is the number one, counter narrative you end up hearing when I start talking about a different way of looking at leadership is it works. You know, what we're doing is we have numbers. Look at, and not just numbers, they'll point to real life change. They'll point to people whose lives have been absolutely transformed. And what I always say is I think that is just evidence that God works with whatever broken thing we give him, mm-hmm. you know, and literally, I mean, that's all we have to give him is a broken thing, you know. So I think that's evidence that God will work with whatever kind of thing we hand to him, not so much that is a particularly faithful way to proceed in ministry. And so I think that it also, you could say also that it betrays kind of a fundamental lack of trust. I mean, we have to ask ourselves as church leaders, what do we believe about God and the power of God? Do we really believe that if we will be faithful, no matter what, even if it appears to have no, you know, discernible, successful stories we can point to, will we be faithful, even though there aren't perceived successes to talk about. I mean, one of the questions I ask in the book is, I'm looking around trying to find pastors or really anybody who will dare to do a small thing faithfully, to do an ordinary thing when nobody's looking. And that kind of virtue funds an entirely different leadership narrative that I believe the Bible teaches and Christ taught unambiguously. It helps us to tap into the fundamental power of the universe, which is that, I mean, the Jesus way is down. His characteristic call was take up your cross and,
sure.
and follow me, right? So that's not a call to greatness. That's a call to lay down your life.
It is indeed very counterintuitive for very, very confusing times we live in. Tim Suttle, senior pastor at Redemption Church in the Kansas City, Missouri area. His brand new book is called Shrink, and we'll have info on this on our website. Pastor Tim, thanks so much. We look forward to hooking up again and having this conversation even further, and we appreciate you being with us this morning.
I love that. Thanks for the time, Austin. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. What a breath of fresh air, quite frankly. What an interesting set of ideas. As I said, we'll have info on the book on our mobile-friendly website at myfaithradio.com. It's 6:25. We'll continue in moments.
There's a place to grow in your faith and share hope with friends and family, with practical resources and insight for your daily life, and it's right at your fingertips. At myfaithradio.com, find the latest podcasts from Faith Radio's original programs. Encourage someone through prayer on PrayerWorks, or be challenged by the latest from our Faith Radio blogging team. It's just a small slice of what's available to you at myfaithradio.com. Log on today to find it's not just information, it's transformation.
Is this one of the first times you've landed on our station? Hello, and welcome to Faith Radio. Here, it's all about connecting faith to your life every day. As a new friend of Faith Radio, we'd love to send you a free welcome packet. It includes a special audio CD with highlights from our original programs and personalized products to introduce you to the ministry. To request your Faith Radio welcome packet, just look for the About button when you visit myfaithradio.com.
Six 26, you're listening to Faith Radio. Great to have you with us. Connecting Faith airs weekdays, 12 noon Central Time here on Faith Radio. Last Friday, host Joe Rathmanner talked with Larissa Murphy. Larissa is the wife of Ian Murray, a young man who's been dealing with a severe brain injury after a freak car accident. On the program, Larissa spoke about what she's learned about her faith through the injury process. Listen to this.
So you wrote beautifully in your book that Ian's disability really helps you to understand a more Christ-like love. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I think in a lot of ways, I know I get to experience God in just a different way than if Ian were healthy. And I mean, one of the most poignant examples to me of getting to see Christ more in our marriage because of Ian's disability is my understanding of forgiveness. Ian struggles with his short-term memory, and so if there's a conflict of some sort, Ian literally in half an hour is not going to remember it. And so he's, in a way, forced to hold no record of wrong, and he offers me forgiveness, and I know that he's not going to be able to recall that. And even though that can be discouraging sometimes, you know, I'd love to have a husband with a functioning short-term memory. On the other hand, it's taught me so much about forgiveness because that's what I'm to do. I'm to forget, and I'm to offer forgiveness and hold no record of wrong and erase the memory of it because Jesus died for me and erased my sins. And so I get to experience that and see that in a much different way than if Ian were totally healthy. And so I think because of his disability, I'm just able to see God in our marriage in much different ways than if he had full health.
So there have to be days when you're frustrated or struggling or like all of us have. Where do you go at that point? Are there particular portions of scripture that you go to, or what happens?
You know, it's a variety, probably depending on how tired I am as well. Ian is the most encouraging person, and when I'm struggling, it's so helpful to talk it through with him because he keeps me grounded, and he points me back to, he says to me so often, so we know God is faithful, and God is good to us, and he's sovereign. And even those, you know, foundational truths, they just reset me, and they reset my gaze. And, you know, the Psalms are very helpful because they're overflowing with honesty and comfort. And, you know, the Psalms were so instrumental even through the very intense moments of Ian's injury in the first couple of months after. And so they continue to be a comfort for me.
Connecting Faith with host Joe Rathmanner, a very, very intriguing conversation, a very important one last Friday. Coming up on today's edition of Connecting Faith, host Neil Stavem speaks with author and pastor Frank Page. They'll talk about his book, Melissa, A Father's Lesson from a Daughter's Suicide. Yet another very sensitive topic here in the midst of National Suicide Prevention Month here in the United States. That's on Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem today, 12 noon. It's now 6:30. Good morning and welcome to Monday. You're listening to Faith Radio. I'm Austin Hill. SRN News is next.
Getting your day started, connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the morning.
Good morning. It's 6:37, and thank you for being here. You realize, of course, as we make our way through the month of September, this is in our country, in the United States of America. If you're listening to us in Canada, this certainly has application, and we encourage you to participate. But in the U.S., it's officially National Suicide Prevention Month, coming up just about an hour from now. An expert in counseling and psychology, Dr. Karen Mason of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in Massachusetts. She will join us to talk about what churches are doing in the U.S. and abroad to help correctly diagnose mental health issues. So stand by for that. That's coming up into the 7 o'clock hour here on Faith Radio. Social media, is that a phenomenon that's necessarily producing more social people? If you've logged on lately or been into your accounts recently, you might question just how social the world of social media is. Joining us to talk about this issue as it pertains to our children and perhaps even our grandkids as well, a lady who, along with Dr. Gary Chapman, has authored a profound book on the matter. It's entitled Growing Up Social, Raising Relational Kids in a Screen-Driven World. Arlene Pelican joins us on the guest line. Arlene, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Austin.
I love this title, A Screen-Driven World. Boy, you couldn't say that more succinctly. For those who are kind of maybe haven't really thought so much about what this screen-driven world is all about and the challenges that it poses to raising relational kids, give us an idea. I guess I don't want to be negative, but give us an idea how bad this is, really. What does the problem look like from your vantage point?
Yeah, my husband and I were at a child's birthday party this weekend, and he met another adult, a parent probably in his 30s or 40s, and the entire time my husband talked to this man, the man had his phone in his hand and was staring at his phone and didn't even look at my husband. And to be honest, that's the first time that something like that had happened. Mm-hmm. But we see it in our children that when someone maybe walks into your house, a guest, a friend, they might not even look up from their tablet, from their TV, whatever. They're just glued to the screen. And you've seen it in restaurants where, wow, look, a family's finally going out to dinner, but wow, they're all on their own device.
Right.
So we see this all around us where it used to be a big TV that everyone went around, but now everything's in our pockets and we're separated by that.
Well, yeah, and, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, Arlene, it seemed to me that those of us in the adult population, we were maybe just getting acquainted with the idea of kids sitting on opposite ends of a couch, not talking to each other, not looking at each other, but texting each other on their mobile phones. And that was even before we knew the phenomena of mobile Facebook or mobile Instagram or what have you. It strikes me that what we call social media, over and above the old school, you know, Internet 1.0, email and texting, the new mechanisms of social media have made matters worse. But what's your assessment on that?
Yeah, I think it's very important for parents, if you have a baby, a toddler, an elementary school student, to say, you know what, this is so much part of a teenager's life that we have got to push this back as much as possible. Because many times you see the toddler, you know, in the grocery store and they're on their iPad and they know how to swipe and they know how to do all these things, but then they get to school, they don't know how to hold a pencil, they don't know how to do these other customary things because they've been on social media so young. So truly a caution for parents of young kids, don't worry, they will get caught up in social media in a snap. Don't worry about it, your child will not be left behind with technology, but where they might be left behind is those social skills of looking at someone in the eye, having empathy for one another. Research shows that college students today are 40% less empathetic than college students 20 years ago, and a lot of that is because when you're messaging someone, you don't see the feelings it produces on the other end when you say either something mean or curse or whatever. You don't see that, and so children are weakening with their relational skills.
Arlene Pelican, she is the co-author of Growing Up Social, Raising Relational Kids in a Screen-Driven World. One of the profound things that you and your co-author, Gary Chapman, have addressed, and you say it so well, Arlene, is that we need to teach our children, especially, that people come first, technology comes second. Wow.
Yeah.
How did we lose sight of that? Well, we did, but tell us where you're going with that.
Yeah, because technology is going to be a part of our lives, and there are wonderful things about technology. You can Skype grandma, keep in touch with your husband who's deployed. You can do all these sorts of things, but what it's done is it's all of a sudden we've become very comfortable with our devices, so much so that we need them. And then you look at people and you think, can you go a whole day without technology? Would that cause any, anxiety in your life? And if the answer is yes, then you realize, wow, I've become too attached to this. So, of course, it was there to serve us and to serve our relationships. But sometimes we've done a flip where, you know, if something chimes, it beeps, and we instantly respond to it. It's like we're slaves to it instead of the person that's sitting right across the table from us. And many times it's our children that we as parents, we are texting, we're on our emails, we're catching up, doing things that seem legitimate, and yet from a child's perspective, if they can't catch our eye, they're going to realize, well, I guess I'm not as important as that phone my mom is holding. Now, does that mean we can't get to business? Of course we can, but we all know that there are times where we don't have to be on social media, but we are. And that's when we have to say, wait a minute, my child and playing this game with my kid or doing these Legos or these blocks, that's going to be more important than what I'm doing right now. And being able to switch gears and show your child you are more important than my social online life.
Very interesting. Now, lest anybody get the idea that I'm going completely negative here on social media, I'm not. We do a lot here at Faith Radio, vis-a-vis Facebook and Twitter and such. And we'll talk with Arlene in a few moments about some of the upsides to social media when we use it properly. But I'm asking her about some of the problems. And Arlene, another part of this that you and your author, co-author Gary Chapman, bring to bear here is the notion that using social media, using computers, taking in information vis-a-vis the computer screen, it strengthens some parts of our brain, but it weakens other parts. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Comment on that if you would, please.
It is a big deal. So what is strengthened is that quick decision making. You know, should I go to link A or link B? Oh, look at that advertisement. Wow, that looks interesting. Let me go to that. So you're able to make these quick decisions, respond very quickly, visual acuity. You can see things in the periphery because you've been playing video games and you know where that thing comes from. Your hand-eye coordination is real good.
Yeah.
You have these things, and that's positive, and that's great. But what's not being used in all those activities, you know, are those deeper concentration, long-term memory, sustained concentration, attention, and you see that in the classroom with kids, that if it's not, you know, exciting and different every 10 seconds that they tune out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a real pitfall of, you know, these attention problems where a child, it's difficult for them to sit through reading something, one thing, static, the whole time for 10 minutes. That's different than reading online, because when you read online, you skim, you scan, you jump, you go from this page, you go from that page. It's very different than the concentration it requires to read a simple book.
You know, just as a little sidebar here, of course, the Faith Radio Network is headquartered here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. I was speaking with the president of our university the other day, and he was saying that social media has posed all kinds of challenges for educators. He said no longer can college professors be, quote-unquote, the sage on the stage. It's not enough to just stand up and speak to a group of people. We've got to be interactive vis-a-vis social media and other resources. Arlene, you're a professional communicator, a very well-educated one at that. Comment, if you would, on how this has changed the ways we educate at home, in the classroom, in the workplace, everywhere.
Yeah, all these things, they can be very welcome, you know, using a visual aid, using an object, making things exciting, pulling kids off of the from the audience and bringing them in. All those things are great, but what you're losing, you know, is the ability of, hey, if this information is really interesting, a child should be able to sit through a 15-minute presentation, you know, and be able to listen to it. And so being able to embrace boredom, perhaps as a parent, so many times we're so quick to say, oh, this is boring for you. Here, let me give you this. This will entertain you. Instead to say, you know what, it is okay for my child even to sit, let's say, through a sermon at church. No offense to any pastor out there, but a child might think, I can't sit through this sermon.
Sure.
Make your child once in a while sit through that sermon so they are able to bring their wandering attention, bring it under control, sit still, listen as best they can, take notes, draw pictures about what the pastor's saying, whatever it is to help a child be able to not be dependent on exciting things and screens and flashing images to keep their attention, but that they can keep their wandering attention through self-control. And that's by training and letting your child be bored on a regular basis.
What a concept. You let your child be bored. Arlene Pellicane, she is the author of Growing Up Social, Raising Relational Kids in a Screen-Driven World. It's a new book out, and Arlene, stand by. We'll continue in just moments. We'll talk with Arlene further about some appropriate and productive uses of social media and how to do it in proportion, shall we say. More in just moments. This is Faith Radio. I'm Austin Hill. And this is Faith Radio. Good morning. I'm Austin Hill. It's 6:49. Growing Up Social, Raising Relational Kids in a Screen-Driven World. That's a new book that has just recently been released on Northfield Publishing. It's co-author Arlene Pellicane. She's still on our guest line here on Faith Radio. So not to completely malign social media, because I think it's a very powerful and useful tool when used properly. But Arlene, when you go out speaking to people about appropriate and proportionately appropriate uses for social media, managing it effectively, you said it so well earlier. You said we become the enslaved to this technology rather than putting the technology to use for our purposes. Where do we begin to make sure we're managing it properly?
Yeah, we can take a step back and think to ourselves, is the way I use social media, is that something I want to pass along to my kids? Is that something that I'd want a friend to emulate? You kind of think about that. So think about the major relationships in your life, and are they being nurtured, or is social media kind of taking you away? It's like bringing you to the masses, but it is making your very close relationships atrophy. You know, I was at a youth conference, and I was thinking this was all about the youth, you know, all about these teenagers, and it was a parent who came to me afterwards and said, a husband who said, my wife is just amazing in so many ways, mm-hmm. but she has discovered social media and she uses it to encourage people, sending them a Bible verse or sending them, you know, I'm praying for you, etc. But what it's made her do is all the time she's on her social media, in the car she's on her social media, they're on dates she's on her social media saying, here's what my husband and I are doing. And he said, I don't know how to get her to stop. And so many times what we've done is we've taken a really great thing, being able to be in touch with friends who are a distance away and bringing them close. And that's wonderful. And having this technology to watch things from all around the world, all of these things are great, but they have to be with intention. Because without the intention of, this is the program I'm going to watch and then I'm going to turn it off, you end up, the whole night is gone and you're like, why'd I sit here for the last 3 hours? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have those boundaries of, this is the amount of time I'm going to use, or this is a particular thing I'm going to do. For instance, for social media, it's endless. So you might say, for 10 minutes, I'm going to check all my social media, get caught up, and then I'm going to turn it off. Because it's too tempting all the time to be checking, because there's always something new there.
Arlene, you've also written eloquently in the book about screen time on social media and parental authority, having appropriate boundaries as mom and dad, being in charge and saying, here's the limits. Where do you begin? And we want to get the book. I want to get the book. I want to read this thing all the way through. I've only read little chunks of it. I'm parenting a teenager, so I'm facing this continually, as you can imagine. But where do you begin a conversation about proper boundaries with the kids and social media?
Yeah. And you can start by thinking, you know, the average student age 8 to 18 is watching 7 hours of screen time a day. So by the time a child is 7, they would have watched one full year of screen media 24 hours a day. And so many times we think in our minds, well, it's just normal. This is what kids are doing. But you have to think, do I want normal? Do I want my kid to have that much screen time while they're in my home and under my influence? So part of it as a parent is assessing, what do I want, what is working, what is not working, and then really scaling back gradually. So for most of us, we don't have the problem like, oh, I'm underusing technology. You know, most of us have the opposite problem of, it's too prevalent in the home. And so instead of saying, like, if your child is playing and watching 5 hours a day, you don't go all of a sudden to zero. You know, your kids are going to think, what happened to you? I want to burn that book. You know, but instead to say, you know what, I've been thinking about this, and I think this is too much what we're watching. We need to be more physically active, at least 1 hour a day. We want to socially do things. So you know what, we're going to trade half an hour of our screen time for outdoor time, where we take a walk around the block, where we exercise, or we're going to trade an hour of screen time for reading time, where you're going to be reading instead. And here's the thing, the kids are not going to like this at first. They're going to like their screen time. And so, of course, be ready for that pushback and do it gradually. So nothing so radical that they don't know what to do. But you could start with, you know, all devices turned in at 10 p.m. or on Saturdays, we're going to go half day with no devices, and start gradually and help your child. Now they're going to resist, but later they will say thank you.
I'm sure they will. And just as a general rule of thumb, this is a very broad, generic question here, but generally speaking, is it really all that important for us to post photographs of our entree or dessert online? I don't know. My tongue is firmly planted in cheek, if you know what I mean, but sometimes I just look at that and think, oh my goodness, this social media stuff has just gone way over the cliff. But I'm sure you've thought about that.
I certainly have. My husband and I were on our anniversary. We were at a little cute B&B, and I got my phone out to take a picture of the water. The water was served in a little cowboy boot, and I saw it like a glass cowboy boot, and I just thought, oh, my goodness, I am becoming those people that always put their phones in the document everything seen. I thought, oh, no, what's happening? So you do. We have to control it to think, is it really so important to share this, or should I just savor this with whoever it is that I'm with?
That's right. Maybe it's just an in-the-moment sort of scenario, and it doesn't need to be seen on the other side of the continent. Anyway, it's Arlene Pelicane, her new book, and it's a good one. We encourage you to check it out, Growing Up Social. We'll get the info for this on MyFaithRadio.com. We'll probably even post it on our Facebook page as well, which will be cool. But use that in proportion. Again, Growing Up Social, some very important information for raising relational kids in a screen-driven world. Arlene, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to continuing this conversation and talking again very soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Austin.
6:55, it's Faith Radio. Going to check in with Susie Larson and Live the Promise next. It's Faith Radio, weekday morning, 6 till 8. That's when I'm here. I'm Austin Hill. Susie Larson hosts Live the Promise, weekday afternoons, 3 till 5 p.m. here at Faith Radio. Last Friday, Susie spoke with Bart Millard, lead singer of the band Mercy Me. That was lots of fun. Here's part of that conversation.
What I would tell the younger version of me is that he's holy, righteous, and redeemed over and over and over and over and over. Because like I say on stage, if it turned my world upside down at 40, how much damage could I have done if I understood that at 8 years old? Mm. And so that's where the song came from. And it was hard. It was a hard song. The hardest part about that song was getting through it without crying. It's a pretty special song to me. And it was the perfect ending to this album. We started with Grace and Identity, and we couldn't think of a better way to wrap the album up.
Mercy Me, the band Mercy Me, Bart Millard, the lead vocalist from that band, a guest of Susie Larson on Live the Promise last Friday afternoon. Coming up on today's episode of Live the Promise, Susie talks with Tricia Lott Williford about finding God's comfort in the toughest times of life. That's Live the Promise, Susie Larson, weekday afternoons 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time, all right here on Faith Radio. Good morning, it's 6:58. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're here. Welcome to Monday. SRN News is next. Good morning, 7:04. Welcome to it. Faith Radio is on live real time. I'm Austin Hill. Glad you're with us. Thank you for being here. Coming up later this hour, of course, we've got Breakpoints. Eric Metaxas, by the way, one of the hosts of the Breakpoint program, made some very, very striking headlines, I guess, at least in the Christian media anyway. Our friends over at ChristianPost.com published a story about this. And I'll have details for this for you on this a little bit later this hour. But Eric Metaxas from Breakpoint speaking at a conference, a gathering of evangelical Christians over the weekend, actually said that Christians in America who are ambivalent or silent on the massive loss of life and slaughtering of Christians in the Middle East vis-a-vis the Islamic State's militant group. He says, those of us here in the United States who are silent on this, we are complicit with evil in much the same way that Christians in Germany and elsewhere around the world were complicit with the evil of Adolf Hitler during the era of Well, the buildup of the Third Reich and Hitler's Germany, and then the evil that's brought to bear World War II. Pretty strong words from Eric Metaxas. Anyway, Breakpoint is coming up in just a few moments here on Faith Radio, so stand by for that. Also, you know, this is suicide, National Suicide Prevention Month, and I know that coming up today at 12 noon on Neil Stavem's program, Connecting Faith, he'll be speaking to an author, a gentleman who is a pastor, whose own daughter committed suicide. Just probably one of the most horrific things that any of us who are parents could imagine. Most of us can't imagine it. I cannot imagine the grief and the pain, even though I've known people who have sustained such a loss. But coming up just about half an hour from now here on our program this morning, Dr. Karen Mason. She is an associate professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. She'll be talking with us about things that churches are doing and things that churches can be doing so as to more effectively address mental health concerns and clinical depression. So all of this and more just ahead. Now, in moments here, we will connect once again with our great friend Lisa Marone, healthcare professional extraordinaire, who's always quick to remind us to get healthy for heaven's sake. And she's written very eloquently, as always, got a very interesting new blog post out entitled, Be Nice to Your Aching Jaw. Be nice to your aching jaw. It never occurred to me that I would do anything mean to my aching jaw, but I'm playing with the title just a little bit here. But she's here to, will be here in just moments to tell us that a mere aching jaw, however inconsequential, however, oh, you know, just routine that may seem, it can very well be indicative of some much more serious problems. And I'm not a healthcare professional. I'm simply speaking as a guy with some experience with this. Jaw issues can be connected with your ears. I learned that the hard way. And any of a number of parts, you know, in your face and cranium and so forth. So how's that for a horribly unsophisticated description? Various parts within your cranium. Well, we'll get more specific and a little more professional. Lisa Marone, once again, who is quick to remind us to get healthy for heaven's sake. We'll check in with her coming up next. Stand by. We'll talk about your aching jaw and much more just ahead. It's 7:08, and this is Faith Radio. Glad you're with us.
To Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
7:09. Welcome to it. Faith Radio is on your radio dial. Yes, we're on your mobile phone. We're on your website. You can find us anytime, the live stream, real time during our live broadcast. You can also find our archived audio. You can click to listen to it or download it and save it as a podcast. All of the above is what we do. You can find us at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. And thank you for being with us here during our program, Austin Hill in the Morning, weekday mornings, 6 till 8. We're talking a fair amount, and I think rightfully so, about National Suicide Prevention Month here at Faith Radio. Certainly, yeah, and one of the, as tumultuous as this last summer was, with news headlines and world events. I hope you had a great summer. My family and I, my wife and son and I, had a terrific summer. I give thanks that we were safe and healthy and were able to afford a nice little family vacation, some time away, lots of fun outings with family and friends and such. That's kind of the norm, or at least historically has been here in the United States, but the world has turned upside down, and the turn of events over the course of the summer have been horrific for our brothers and sisters, fellow sojourners of the Christian faith in other parts of the world. That said, here domestically in the U.S., one of the things that got a lot of attention here at home was the very tragic, very horrific suicide of Robin Williams, actor Robin Williams, and you probably remember that very well. Well, we devoted a fair amount of time to talking about not just Robin Williams, the man, but suicide in general and symptoms and clinical problems that lead up to suicide. We devoted a fair amount of time to this here on the Faith Radio Network. And so also, not only on our talk network, but other radio stations and media outlets owned and operated by Northwest Media, which, of course, is a part of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We have several Christian music radio stations in many of the marketplaces where our talk format is broadcast, this show. And myself and Neil Staven with Connecting Faith, Live the Promise with Susie Larson, music formats and other signals around the country. And so really all of the radio properties and media ventures owned and operated by Northwest Media, likewise Christian broadcasters all over the country, I think really stepped up to the plate, and I don't mind saying so. This is not just prideful comments here from Northwest Media, but very thoughtful broadcasters all over the country did a great job bringing to bear, drawing attention to, appropriately so, the problem of suicide. And in particular, you don't go too many layers deep into suicide before you start talking about issues of clinical depression. And one of the impetuses, is that a word, impetuses? Is that how you say impetus in the plural? I hope so. One of the many reasons why the National Suicide Prevention Month movement has been brought to bear is in no small part because of the many health, mental health complications brought to bear by military veterans. In particular, we've seen this surge since the early days last decade of warfare and military conflict in the Middle East. Seen yet another surge. We saw this in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and the mental health profession was not as well developed back in the late 60s and early and mid 70s when Vietnam War veterans were coming home, returning to the United States. But we certainly were able to identify mental health problems, clinical symptoms, and really studies of military veterans from the Vietnam War era. Those studies brought to bear our understanding of what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, quite frankly, in the aftermath of soldiers, military personnel returning back from Iraq and Afghanistan, I might add, we've seen a resurgence of post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as other kinds of clinical symptoms. And many of these things all kind of devolve into, and I'm using this term very non-clinically and very loosely and broadly, but a lot of these different kinds of symptoms and problems sort of devolve into what we would regard as depression of one sort or another. And so National Suicide Prevention Month, actually, again, it's a movement across the country, and it was brought to bear in no small part because of the plight and the suffering of military veterans. I will tell you that within my own social and professional circles, I have direct connection with an individual who has a member of their family who was a military veteran, served, I believe, a couple of tours of duty in Iraq, and came back home to the United States, was having difficulty finding employment, married, young children in the household, and this gentleman took his own life. And it's just absolutely devastating what gets left behind. So it strikes me, and I think this is a very positive thing, the Christian community, the evangelical community, is stepping up in very significant ways to begin addressing this. And oftentimes this starts with conversations, being willing to talk about a topic that for some, in the minds of some, it's very taboo. I mean, the idea that one could be stuck in depression long term, for some of us, that just doesn't match with our faith and our beliefs about our faith and our faith commitments. We have this notion that somehow once we become a Christian, we accept Christ as our Savior for eternity, somehow the rest of our earthly journey is supposed to be moving nowhere but upwards, and it's supposed to feel good, and we're supposed to be happy, and we're supposed to do all these things. But as I read the scriptures, and perhaps this is true for you as well, the scriptures say our earthly journey necessarily will entail suffering of one sort or another. Let's come alongside. Let's be more acutely aware of those who are suffering with depression. That's why we're talking about it here on Faith Radio, coming up in just about 20 minutes from now. Talk to an expert on such things, so stand by for that. It's now 7:16. You're listening to Faith Radio. I am Austin Hill. I'm here weekday mornings 6 till 8 as we connect faith to life while you're getting your day started. Our program continues in moments. Don't go away.
Thank you.
connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
Good morning. It's now 7:19, and you're listening to Faith Radio. Glad you're with us. Thank you for being here. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8, as you get your day started, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful. Breakpoints with Eric Metaxas and John Stone Street along the way, coming up in just a few moments. You've heard the news about the spread of the Ebola virus. And there's a lot of, quite frankly, there's a lot of hyperbole, a lot of hype, and a lot of sensationalism with which a lot of this news is getting reported, I think. And that's one of the reasons why we're so grateful to have the regular commentary and input here of Dr. David Stevens. He's a medical doctor, of course, with the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. And he joins us every week and a half to 2 weeks or so to comment on such things. And he has been a real voice of reason in the midst of the craziness. And there have been some other people, I think, that have kind of picked up on his comments and other sober-minded and thoughtful comments from other medical professionals like Dr. Stevens, who said, listen, this is not an airborne thing. The Ebola virus does not get spread in the air, and this is not something that is poised to just take off and sweep across the continental United States or North America or what have you. It is nonetheless spread through bodily contact, bodily fluids, and when and where public health standards are not up to par so as to prevent it. And that would include a lot of poorer, more impoverished nations on the continent of Africa. And you've also, in the midst of all this, you probably heard the name Dr. Kent Brantley. He is a Christian medical missionary, a gentleman who grew up in the Indianapolis, Indiana area. We've talked a fair amount about him here on this program. Went on to college and graduate school, medical school, became a medical doctor, and went right back to his hometown in Indianapolis. And by the way, moved back in and started attending once again the church in Indianapolis that he grew up in as a child. And that's where he and his wife were raising their children and such. And about 2 years ago, Dr. Brantley believed that God had called him to go be a medical missionary in the country of Liberia. And so he left all the comforts of home in Indianapolis and moved to the capital city in Liberia, Monrovia. And as the story goes, as the story went, I should say, over the summer, he was diagnosed as being infected with the Ebola virus. He was brought home and kept in a quarantine medical facility at a hospital in the Atlanta, Georgia area. He is now, thank God, well on his way to recovery. That's a good story. And by the way, the folks at NBC Television News, of all the news media outlets in the country to choose to do this, it was NBC. All the news media outlets that could have chosen to do this, NBC was the only one who did a profile of Dr. Kent Brantley and did an extraordinary job, really, I believe, capturing the facts and capturing the truth of the matter, that this man was compelled to go be a missionary doctor by his faith in God. His Christian faith led him to do this. But that's a happy, I guess at least a happy outcome anyway, in the midst of the horrors and the tragedy of the Ebola virus. That's a positive, a successful story of a relief worker who got his life back. I mean, Dr. Brantley was near death. I also want you to know, and this is something that I believe should be a cause for concern and a cause for prayer among us here in the United States in particular, we had very tragic news of relief workers, and I don't even know if their nationality or their identity has been actually succinctly spelled out just yet. They may very well have been Americans. But we had a team of relief workers working in another country in on the continent of Africa, this one in the western region of the continent. It's a country called Guinea, not New Guinea, but Guinea. And some relief workers, a team of nine of them actually, were sent into remote and very rural villages across the little tiny country of Guinea to warn people. I mean, they weren't even trying to administer medical treatment. They were simply warning people that this illness is being spread all over the continent, all over the country, and here's the precautions that you need to take. There was a mix of physicians and healthcare leaders, a mix of Christian ministers, and as I understand it, two journalists, a part of this team. And they were all shot and killed and hacked to death by men with machetes. 24 hours after their arrival into a particular village in the country of Guinea. Violence broke out, allegedly sparked by the false belief that a disinfectant being sprayed across the community was actually the disease itself. An angry mob brandishing machetes, rocks, knives, and guns just really stabbed and shot and killed these relief workers to death. One little miscommunication, a little inaccurate data point. Here, these relief workers were coming into town saying, be prepared, get ready, and by the way, we're going to spray the area to try to kill the virus. One little misinformation, piece of misinformation, and nine relief workers, people who had sacrificially left the free world. And my understanding is, and again, the precise identities and nationalities of these relief workers have not been identified completely as yet, but it is pretty well understood with the multiple reports that I've seen that these individuals had come from somewhere on another continent, either from North America or Europe, and were volunteering their time sacrificially to try to help these people, and they lost their lives in the process. Very tragic events. We give thanks for the success of Dr. Kent Brantley and those who are doing this good work. And by the way, we've got a whole bunch of our U.S. military troops dispatched into various parts of Africa to work with infrastructure to try to keep societies intact and civil as this virus sweeps across. But this is some of the dangers that relief workers face. Missionary relief workers, if you will. I hope you'll join me and be in prayer for them. 7:25 now, this is Faith Radio. You're listening to it. I'm Austin Hill. When we come back, Breakpoints. Don't go anywhere. Good morning at 7:35. You're listening to Faith Radio. Thank you for being here. I am Austin Hill. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8 as you get your day started and as we seek to connect faith to life. And thank you for listening. Thank you for your support as well. Find us anytime. And we invite you to join us and to partner with us at any time. Find us at myfaithradio.com. Well, it's fall. Students are back to school. A lot of us have wrapped up family vacation plans if we were able to afford any at all over the summer months. Our schedule disruptions are kind of past tense, at least for the foreseeable future, and we're back into a routine. One of the things that really disrupted America, quite frankly, in many ways, over the summer months was the very high-profile suicide death of one of our own, Robin Williams, entertainer extraordinaire, actor and comedian and writer of extraordinary proportions. Who knew that the funny guy on stage and on TV and in the motion pictures was really suffering greatly? Well, indeed, in the aftermath of his death by strangulation, he hung himself for all intents and purposes based on what we know. It's just awful. In the aftermath of that, we learned a very sad tale of his struggle with clinical depression. So it does raise the question, what is the role of those of us who are blessed with good mental health? What is the role of us? And specifically, what is the role of the church in our broader culture when it comes to dealing with issues of depression and other symptoms that lead one to contemplate suicide? Joining us to talk about it, Karen Mason. She is a PhD. She is author of a brand new book called Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. She's also a professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Dr. Karen Mason, welcome to our program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and please call me Karen.
I will indeed, Karen. It strikes me that you are addressing an issue that historically, over a good bit of my lifetime, and perhaps yours as well, has been regarded as kind of taboo, something that we just don't want to deal with, especially within Christian church circles. But it seems to me also that that's beginning to change. But where are we at, as you see it, Karen, when it comes to openly and forthrightly talking about depression and suicide in church?
Well, as you point out, Austin, I do think there's some road ahead of us, but I do think also that there is some discussion, some conversation going on around this, perhaps due to some situations, very high-profile situations, as you were describing earlier, but also I think sometimes very unfortunately our, you know, members of our very own churches sometimes struggle as well. And when we become aware of that, I think that also helps to change that conversation.
How do you go about changing the conversation when somebody perhaps contacts you, Karen, and says, we've got a crisis in our church, or I'm a pastor, and there's somebody contacting me for help, and I just don't know what to do? Where does that process lead?
Yeah, I think you were pointing out earlier that very often suicidal thinking occurs in the context of a mental health struggle that a person might have. So I do think finding mental health resources in the community is just so important. And there are so many good Christian counselors out there who are, you know, would be able to help. I think also another resource that would be really important for all of us to be aware of is just the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline,
mm-hmm.
which is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, 1-800-273-TALK. I just think that's an important resource. It's a 24/7 crisis line. So when a person is thinking about suicide and there's a concern for this person's safety, you could call that Lifeline phone number. There's a connection to the Veterans Crisis Line for veterans. There's opportunity for Spanish speakers as well to be connected to somebody. And I think really in those situations, you know, safety is just so important, a focus on safety. And I think that Lifeline can help.
Yeah, very interesting. Dr. Karen Mason, Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. She also has a book that she's written called Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. Comment further, elaborate if you would, Karen, on this concept of safety. My guess is that you're talking about emotional safety every bit as much as physical safety, but please explain.
Yes, exactly. I do think that, you know, when you're talking about emotional safety, I think when we're talking about the context of having a mental health problem that kind of creates that context for suicidal thinking, you know, a person in that situation is just feeling such great despair. And so I think there is that issue of emotional safety, but also that great despair can sometimes create risk when it comes to physical safety as well. And I think that's why I think the focus in that situation, you know, a helpful focus in that situation is safety. I think also, just to give you kind of a bigger picture about this, I think there are so many ways the church helps with suicide prevention, and I think one way to prevent a tragedy of any kind to create safety could be to help. Say, for instance, you could stand by a stream and pull people out of a stream. But another way is to go upstream and build a fence around the place where people are falling in. And I think the upstream, the church does so much, pastors do so much in terms of building protections, creating safety against suicide, like giving people reasons for living, guidance for how to build lives worth living, you know, teaching people how to manage the suffering in their life in a faithful way, offering people community to which people can belong and contribute to meaningfully, and also just plain old providing people with moral objections and theological objections to suicide. You know, the research has shown that that's another important thing that the church does.
Very interesting. So if we are to have a conversation and say, hey, God doesn't want you to take your life, and we see evidence of that in the scriptures, that has compelling influence for some people, you're saying?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely correct. Right. And I think, you know, when it comes to theology of suicide, very definitely you can read about a spectrum of views, but what the theme really that runs through that is what exactly what you were saying, which is that God, you know, wants us to find ways to stay alive despite the great challenges that we are facing. And I think being able to communicate to that, to people that, you know, that we can't condone suicide, I think, is a helpful thing that can create safety for some people.
Yeah, yeah. And tell us about the fine line. At least I would think it's a fine line between condoning suicide and maybe passively not doing enough to prevent it. Is there kind of a fine line that maybe sometimes we get stuck in there? We're not sure if we should be proactive or reactive or just sit tight and wait. Comment on that, if you would.
You know, your question, what it brings up for me is just that I think there's a lot of confusion sometimes around suicide. We have certain myths that operate for us, and things like maybe it's better if I just don't talk about this and maybe it will go away. And so I think that, being able to bring out and have a more frank conversation about some of these things, I think can be so helpful, because sometimes I think our myths do get in the way of being able to intervene maybe in more effective ways.
Dr. Karen Mason, she is a professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. She's also author of the new book, Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. Karen, I'm going to ask you to stand by here for just a few moments. We'll continue. Just a quick break here. This is a very important subject, and if you or somebody you know is hurting right now and not sure where to turn, stand by. We will talk through that with Karen Mason as we continue. It's 7:45. You're listening to Faith Radio. We're glad you're here. I'm Austin Hill. Now 7:47, you're listening to Faith Radio, where we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as you get your day started. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday morning 6 till 8. Dr. Karen Mason is an associate professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in Massachusetts. She's also the author of the book Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. She's here addressing this very sensitive but all-important issue of mental health problems and suicide, even among Christians within the church. And Karen, I want to pick up on some things that you were referencing earlier. We talked a little bit about how our theology can and sometimes should inform our understanding of mental health problems and despair and suicide and such. It also occurs to me that for some people, the very notion that we're living in a sense or a spirit of despair really becomes kind of conflictual with our notion of what it is to be a victorious Christian. Being victorious means, you know, your world's apart from despair, and yet it seems to me a closer rendering of the scriptures would tell us that indeed following Christ is oftentimes a pathway of suffering. But how do you pull that together as you work with pastors in training, you advise people in churches, and this issue of, gosh, I got somebody in our church that's living in despair and I don't know what to do. How do you begin to address that conflict?
Right. And it is so true that ultimately we do have the victory in Christ, and that the, when Christ comes back, we will be living without pain and suffering, but that here on earth we do, and we do have brokenness. You know, we live kind of both sides of that coin. We live as redeemed people, but at the same time we live as people who are touched by the fall, who are broken, and because of that brokenness sometimes we experience things like mental health problems. So, you know, or diabetes or cancer or something like that. And so so we live both sides of that coin, and I think that's what's really challenging about life as Christians. But at the same time, you know, you were talking about having that ultimate hope. So we despite that fact, despite of living on both sides of that coin, we still, you know, believe in the great physician's ability to heal us, not only, you know, with diabetes, but also with things that we struggle with, like mental health problems or suicidal thinking. So we still continue to pray to God. We ask for healing, despite the fact that we realize, too, that oftentimes we don't have that guarantee, but we continue to live in that place of dependence on, you know, the great physician. We stand firm with people who are suicidal, whose hope is eroded, and we claim for them our faithful certainty in the God who's present and loving and sovereign, and we lament the brokenness of this world, and we wait for God to redeem suffering and create that new heaven and the earth. You know, and I think in the meantime, we help people get treatment for the brokenness that we see around us, whether it's diabetes, cancer, or depression, or suicidal thinking. And I think we offer so many important things in the church, like, you know, love, the love of a community of faith surrounding a person who's suffering. So we offer that non-judgmental ministry of presence. So, I mean, there are so many things. We offer those small things like practical help with meals or rides to the doctor or the psychiatrist or whatever happens. So I just think there are so many things that we do in the community of faith that are that acknowledge the great brokenness that we see around us, but at the same time, you know, incarnate the love of Christ for people who are suffering, not just people who are suffering with diabetes or cancer, but also people who have depression or suicidal thinking, that sort of thing.
Karen Mason, what would you say to the person listening right now, and maybe they are living with a sense of despair, maybe there's somebody in their own household or their own family who just seems like they can't snap out of it. We've tried to pull them back. We've tried to offer encouragement and help, but things continue to get worse. And maybe even somebody is listening right now who's living in fear that they may hurt themselves or somebody near to them may do something harmful. Offer a word of encouragement, a word of advice, if you would.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really think that for the most part, suicidal thinking occurs within that context of a mental health problem. So I would very much encourage somebody whose family member or themselves is suffering in that way. I would say that there are just excellent treatments out there, and the important thing is to get connected with mental health services and to get that treatment that's going to make a difference. We know that a lot of people in the United States struggle but don't get treatment. So, but there are good treatments, and people just aren't connected to them or aware of them. So I would encourage you in that way. I would say that if there's a concern around a person's safety in an imminent kind of way, I would suggest that you have them evaluated in a hospital emergency department, or at least give the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline a call, the 1-800-273-TALK phone number. So
sure.
That would be my encouragement.
And to the pastor or lay minister who is perhaps a bit overwhelmed about the people, or overwhelmed with the people they're trying to serve, we should say, I certainly would encourage a copy of your book, Preventing Suicide, a Handbook for Pastors, Chaplains, and Pastoral Counselors. That's on the InterVarsity Press label. Any final comments to the ministry worker, Karen?
Well, I just think I just want to encourage the ministry workers. I have to say, you know, the way I became interested in this topic is that I read about a very large national study where 25% of people who struggled with suicidal with all kinds of mental health problems went to clergy, and that suicidal thinking was one of the sort of motivators to come talk to clergy. And it just really I know that these people are coming to clergy for help, and I just want to encourage clergy people. I just think that they just play you know, such an important role in the area of suicide prevention, but of course just that their role isn't just confined to that. It's just such an overall important role in terms of the ministry that they do for people and for faith communities. And I just I have great admiration and pray for people in that role continuously, just because I think it's just these folks just have an incredible ministry to their faith. Yeah.
Indeed they do. Dr. Karen Mason, her book, Preventing Suicide, A Handbook for Pastors, Chaplains, and Pastoral Counselors. We'll get info on this on our mobile-friendly website, of course, myfaithradio.com. Karen Mason, thank you for what you do. Thanks for joining us. I look forward to speaking with you again soon, and we appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to talk with you. And again, reach out if you know somebody who's suffering, if you yourself are suffering. Here's a lifeline right here, 800-273-TALK, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. 7:55, this is Faith Radio. Glad you're with us. I'm Austin Hill. Good morning, and thank you for being here. You're listening to Faith Radio. We appreciate you being with us weekday morning, 6 till 8. I'm Austin Hill, and we try to provide a program that's informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as you get your day started. Now, coming up on tomorrow's episode of our program, a gentleman named Doug Clark will join us, and he'll be talking about a movement that's been going on for, I want to say, close to 25 years or so. It's called See You at the Poll. Now, National See You at the Poll Day is coming up Wednesday, 2 days from now. And See You at the Poll, P-O-L-E, that may sound like people gathering together to vote, right, at the polling place. No, it's not that. It's actually students gathering of their own accord, gathering with one another around the flagpole of their campus, if indeed there is a flagpole, to pray for themselves, their fellow students, and their school. What's going on with the See You at the Poll movement? We'll get an update on that coming up tomorrow. Also, our great friend Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He'll weigh in on some of the big new proposed changes in healthcare in America as it pertains to end-of-life issues. Very serious matters facing us. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning at 6. Have a great day. Keep it right here. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.